Hello, everyone, and welcome to the OLR Podcast, Episode 9. My name is Grace Alshami, and I'm an associate editor and a member of the podcast committee here at the Ottawa Law Review. Today, I will be speaking with Andrew Stobo Snyderman about his article titled Clearly a Subjective Determination, Interpretations of Undue Suffering at the Canada Agricultural Review Tribunal, which was published in Volume 53, Issue 2 of the Ottawa Law Review. Just a reminder, the OLR is an open access journal and this article is accessible on the OLR website. So if you have not already done so, you can access the article there. Andrew Stobo Snyderman is a writer, lawyer, and Rhodes Scholar from Montreal. He is the co-author of the forthcoming book, Valley of the Birdtail, An Indian Reserve, A White Town, and the Road to Reconciliation with Douglas Sanderson. He has published reporting and opinions in the New York Times, the Globe and Mail, Maclean's, the Toronto Star, the Montreal Gazette, the Ottawa Citizen, and England's Sunday Times. His profile of Canada's Truth and Reconciliation Commission on Residential Schools won the award for Best Print Feature of 2011 from the Canadian Association of Journalists. As a lawyer, Stobo has argued before the Supreme Court and advocated for Indigenous clients. He has also served as the Human Rights Policy Advisor to the Minister of Foreign Affairs and as a law clerk for a judge of South Africa's Constitutional Court. Hello, Mr. Snyderman. Thank you very much for being here with us.
Thanks, Grace. And you forgot to add on my bio that I've now published in the Ottawa Law Review.
Yes.
Very excited.
Yes. So first, could you provide a brief overview of your article? So the study you carried out, your findings, your arguments, etc.
Yeah. Again, glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
So this article is about animal suffering and how a particular administrative tribunal, which is called the Canada Agricultural Review Tribunal, maybe we could just call it the Agricultural Tribunal today, how they tried to deal with animal suffering. And there's some federal rules that were in existence for about 20 years that I'm looking at. And these rules say that it's not permissible for animals to have undue suffering, quote unquote. And there's different rules that involve that concept. And I'm following how this tribunal has tried to apply that idea of undue suffering for 20 years to try to see what we make of it.
And what prompted this research on this very specific topic? Why did you ultimately decide to write this article?
I was a student doing an LLL at the University of Ottawa faculty, and I was taking a class with Professor Sarah Berger Richardson, and she teaches a class on food law. And it was during this class that I encountered this tribunal, which I had never heard of, called the Canada Agricultural Review Tribunal. And to my astonishment, they had these unbelievably detailed cases about animals suffering and dying and trying to figure out whether this was permissible or not. And so there was this huge body of cases. And it seemed like no one had really looked at this before, and it might be interesting to figure out how our legal system tried to figure out what was okay and what was not okay when it came to the treatment of animals being specifically transported to slaughter. It was like this small window into the soul of our food system.
Right. And could you explain to the listeners what kinds of cases are heard before the Canada Agricultural Review Tribunal?
Yeah, I think they hear a lot of cases, but the ones we're looking at is where someone who is transporting animals to slaughter, they got fined for doing something wrong. Some official fined them for doing something wrong, and the person who was fined appealed that decision, and it goes to this tribunal. Who had to determine whether the fine was appropriate. So that's where these cases are coming from. And then, of course, if the person's not happy with that decision, they can appeal it to federal court, which is what happens in a couple of important cases.
And you talk a lot about the difference between suffering and undue suffering in your article. So could you explain to us what the difference is between the two terms as per the Doyon decision?
I wish I could truly explain in a clear way what that distinction was. And maybe that's part of where the article is coming from. So I was drawn to this phrase, undue suffering, which was appearing in these regulations for a long time. And what's interesting about the way that's phrased, of course, is that due suffering is okay. There's this idea that undue suffering is unacceptable. And so it's implied that some suffering is acceptable. And that is the interpretation that ends up getting affirmed in this important federal court of appeal decision that you just referred to, Doyon, in 2009. And they say something to the effect of, well, some suffering is okay. Otherwise, we would have said suffering is not okay, but we said undue suffering is unacceptable. So we have this result, which is that the court saying, look, there's going to be some suffering. It's okay. And we need to try to draw the line somewhere about really what is undue, which is another way of saying unreasonable, which is, of course, a word that appears all over our legal system and the case law. And what we see is that the tribunal subsequently really struggles to figure out what that means. And there's these almost plaintive notes of, in the tribunal decision, subsequently, they say, appeals court above, please give us clearer guidance. We want no deference to us. Please just help us out because we're really struggling. And I think it's pointing at this larger thing that's happening in our legal system all the time, which is that we have vague standards and tribunals or decision makers have to interpret that in specific situations, and that's very difficult. And I hope part of the reason this paper is illuminating is that you kind of follow for 20 years how these tribunals are trying to do that very difficult thing, which is to translate a vague idea or set two vague words with some guidance from appeals courts to hard cases of animals suffering and dying en route to slaughter.
And I was wondering if, under the law, if there's a difference between suffering caused by circumstances that can be controlled by humans, such as crowdedness, of the crates, versus suffering caused by factors that can't be controlled, such as the weather, for example.
I think part of the answer to the question is that there is a provision that says it's not okay to unduly expose animals to the weather. And so that provision's not explicitly, and that's connected to undue suffering. So there's two undues in that wording. You can't cause undue suffering with undue exposure to the weather. I think that would capture the kind of thing you're talking about as these provisions were written. So if there was a horrible tempestuous storm and it was an unduly tempestuous day and the animals suffered unduly because of that, that would be not okay. But I think you're getting at something which which ends up bothering an appeals court, which is, you know, are reasonable efforts a defense for suffering? You know, is there a due diligence defense? And there was not.
Right.
There was not. And it was not a criminal penalty. It was a fine. There was a monetary fine attached to this. But the appeals court in 2009 is really troubled by this. You know, if I was diligent and something bad still happened, that should be a defense, and it was not. And it leads the court to warn against liberal interpretations of undue suffering, and the court kind of takes a step back and to create more room to maneuver for people operating in the agricultural space.
Right. And it seems like there are three perspectives on what constitutes undue suffering or suffering when it comes to animals. Do you agree that the perspectives of those working in the meat supply chain, animal welfare science experts, and animal activists have different ideas of the term? And how should the court reconcile these differences in establishing a legal test?
Yeah, I think, you know, none of us should be surprised that there's differences of opinion.
Yeah.
And I think you're gesturing at this larger issue, which is, you know, what do we do with these vague words? And why do we have these vague words? Some might say that we have these vague terms so that everyone can kind of agree on it in some level. And so if you're raising animals for slaughter, you might agree that, yes, undue suffering is not okay. And if you're an activist, you might agree on that terminology. And perhaps one of the reasons we keep things vague is to make it possible to agree on words. But I think what you also see in the cases is that there's this attempt to balance, you know, the commercial reality of producing vast quantities of meat for consumption and the suffering of animals. And we're going to have dramatic disagreements about where that right balance should be struck. And, you know, activists didn't really have a direct input into this system, as far as I could tell. They were not interveners in the cases that I could see. There was not that level of organization to participate in the tribunal. So, you feel free to probe more deeply on that, but I'm going to keep thinking about that.
Okay. And you write that the tribunal had made pleas to the federal court to help it define undue suffering from the former regulations and to ignore the typical position of judicial deference to an expert administrative board such as itself. Can you talk about how shocking that is to see in administrative law cases and what that means for the capacity and expertise of the Canada Agricultural Review Tribunal?
Yeah, you've probably studied admin law more recently than me. I was shocked. And I think it's a bit shocking because the law as it stands is meant to accord deference to a tribunal like this. And here is a tribunal saying, please give us guidance. Do not be deferential to what we're doing. Please just help us out. And I think, you know, that's interesting, but I think it speaks to this larger difficulty that any set of people are going to have in applying a vague standard. And, you know, to get back to a question you were asking earlier, if it's helpful to add, I think the reason the word undue existed in the first place before suffering was to try to account for this balancing act that the government, who created the rules in the first place, is trying to strike between the welfare of animals and perhaps the perspective of activists and the views of an industry that's producing a lot of jobs and money and meat for consumption. And to me, it was instructive as just one example of the really fascinating issue to me, at least, which is, you know, how much vagueness do we want in our rules in this, in general, and in this kind of area? And maybe that's what, you know, that's what the paper, I hope that's one of the big questions it's asking. And it forces you to reflect on the virtues of vagueness. Mm-hmm. And one of the virtues is that, you know, you can change with the times. The standards can change with the times. And, you know, a virtue of our Constitution, some of our constitutional provisions maybe, is that they're vague. And so it allows us to kind of shift with the norms of the day. And I was mentioning an earlier virtue of vagueness, which is that perhaps you can get different actors who have huge disagreements to agree on vague language for us to move forward. But there's a cost to the vagueness. And I think in this context, I think the animals pay the price for the vagueness, because the decision maker, I think, is reluctant to penalize unless you're really outside the bounds of reasonableness. And it may be a silly example, and I'm not sure what you made of it, but, you know, we don't punish people for undue speeding
right
on the road. And I think there's a reason we don't. It's because in some contexts, we need, when we can, to have really clear guidance. And in some contexts, like a constitution, maybe you don't. So, and it's tough. It is really tough. And I think what I saw when I looked at all these cases of animals is that they got the short end of the stick in how this played out. And perhaps had there been more specific rules with clear outcomes to avoid or means to avoid, then perhaps that is a better way to do it. And I think perhaps it takes more effort from the regulator to promulgate that kind of rules and to really stay on top of the industry as it's changing, which it constantly is. So we need to ask ourselves in this and other contexts, what are the virtues of specificity and what are the virtues of vagueness? And is this going to get us where we want to go in this particular area?
Right. And the amendments provide some amount of perspective direction on how animals should not be transported and signs to look for that show they're unfit for transport. Like you mentioned in your article, like labored breathing, severe open wounds, or signs of dehydration. Do you think that current regulations are precise enough to avoid animal suffering in transit to slaughterhouses?
Yeah, I think you're referring to the fact that a couple years ago, the rules were changed.
Yes.
And they became more specific, and they actually got rid of this undue suffering standard. And so a future researcher, hopefully, will look at what difference this is making. And, you know, I give reasons near the end of the paper to kind of doubt that this is as great as it sounds.
Right.
And I'm reluctant to say, in response to your question, you know, whether things are better. I'm not sure. I think what I did conclude was that the rules that were enforced from 2000 to 2019, I think, could have used more specificity. And so I'm inclined to say that the more specific rules now are a good thing. But I would love for someone to follow up by taking a close look at what's going on, to talk to the people who are trying to decide whether there should be fines. And I suspect that things are better if the rules are being enforced, which is a big if, but I'm not sure. And I'll take one more moment to say that supposedly, according to federal, an interpretive document that came out with the rule change, they said no suffering is okay.
Right.
Apparently that's the position we've got now. And then there's this really strange phrase that comes right after, which is, but, you know, there might be a little bit of adaptive stress in transport that is okay. And so, again, you can kind of see the rulemaker trying to say, well, suffering is not okay, but stress is okay, which perhaps sounds a little bit like undue suffering is not okay, but a little bit of suffering is okay. And so I think, you know, it's this implied recognition that this is a very brutal business.
Right.
And we can pretend like there's no suffering going on, but if the industry is anything like it was a few years ago, which I suspect it is, there are thousands and tens of thousands and hundreds of thousands of animals that are dying during this transport, and they're in pain. And whether or not that amounts to suffering, you know, becomes a legal question, but I think we can't lose track of our common sense, which should tell us that, you know, it's ugly. It's still ugly.
Yeah. And this next question is a little more specific, but I was really curious. You mention in your article somewhere in the beginning that it is far more common for fines to be levied and paid without further contestation before the CART or beyond before a federal court. Mm-hmm. And I was curious to know, why do you think that is?
Yeah, I think I'm making maybe a simpler point, which is that sometimes as law students and as people reading cases, we have to be reminded that, oh, if it's a case, it's because someone was contesting what happened. And so, you know, the vast majority of the time when there's disputes out in the world, whether in this domain or in others, you know, people just kind of sort it out. It doesn't become a tort case unless someone gets really upset and decides they need to go to court, and it ends up not settling and it ends up reaching a decision. So I think what I'm saying there is the cases we have is not necessarily reflective of the everyday reality of how this system works. And that's true of all law. You know, it's kind of
right.
Like the outer edges of what's going on. When it's more obvious, people aren't contesting the decisions. So it's not like it's a representative sample of reality. And I think perhaps as you are experiencing in your second year of law school, you can read a lot of cases and you can have kind of dark thoughts about humanity. It's like, man, there's danger around every corner and there's horrible things happening everywhere.
Yeah.
It's like only reading the French page of the news where there's doom and gloom and, you know, that's not all of what reality is, although obviously it's happening. So, that it's more like a note of caution I was giving.
Okay.
And also, I don't know, maybe if I had more time as a researcher in the future, it would be interesting to go talk to the people levying the fines and ask, you know, what are you seeing? You know, how often are you? I couldn't find a record of how many fines were levied versus how many fines were appealed. I'd like to know that. I think that would be interesting to know. You know, how many people just say, yeah, that was bad. I'll pay that fine. Or whether the person levying the fine in the first place, what is going through their mind as they try to think through what's suffering, what's not, you know, that would also be interesting to think about.
Right. And the Canada Agricultural Review Tribunal seems like an under the radar administrative tribunal. So how impactful is its work on the welfare of animals?
Short answer is, I don't know.
Okay.
But I would encourage the vast number of people who will listen to this podcast to take another look at what they're doing.
Yeah.
Because there's all kinds of interesting cases, and it's clear that they're doing their best. You know, we were saying a little bit earlier that maybe it's a bit surprising that they were asking for more guidance, and perhaps I was not as charitable as I should be, because these are good faith people doing their best
right.
with the words that they have to apply. And it's really hard. You know, it really is hard what they're trying to do. So I'm glad they're doing the work that they're doing. And I think it does have an impact, clearly, in the cases that come before them. And I think perhaps in the guidance that they're impliedly giving to industry. And, you know, another reason why I think their work is really, really important is that the record they leave us with their decisions is, I think, invaluable as an X-ray of the agricultural food system that we've got. And I, at least, you know, found it surprising and a bit horrifying, quite a bit horrifying, actually, the facts, you know, the facts yeah. of the cases.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we were talking before we started to record about, you know, our vegan thoughts in the past and in the present. And it's hard, you know, I was unsettled just yeah. by the facts. And so I think the record they're creating alone for all of us to take an unvarnished look at what is going on in some of these cases is of immense value. I don't think it's just historical, because we can look at it in real time and say, yikes, that's bad.
Yeah.
And we could, of course, as Canadians, decide, you know, this is unacceptable and we need to change the rules, not just for this tribunal to behave differently, but just for our food system to behave differently. And so if there's some kind of, you know, hope I have with the paper, part of it is just to say, you know, this tribunal is giving us this, they're telling these stories that could and should move us to think differently about how we're producing food, or at least it made me feel that way.
Right. And speaking of unsettling facts, your research found shocking examples of animal suffering en route to slaughterhouses, with single cases of thousands of chickens or a truckload of sheep freezing to death. And you also mentioned that 4% of chickens seems to be the acceptable level of chickens dying in transit. And any less than that doesn't really trigger an automatic investigation. Is that a practical consideration? And who is responsible for calculating it? Is it the slaughterhouses?
That's a lot of chickens, right?
Yeah, that is.
Yeah. Yeah, well, there were these very disquieting passages, which you also were disquieted by, it seems, where the tribunal says something like, you know, one death is too many, of course. And so they're also saying that the agency, the federal agency responsible for enforcing these rules in the first place, and you could maybe correct me or tell me exactly which administrative body is enforcing the fines, but it's somewhere in the agricultural department. You know, they have this internal rule, which is, well, if 4% of chickens die, we definitely need to take a second look.
Yeah.
And so the tribunal on the one hand is saying, you know, it's not like under 4% is always okay.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just a few deaths could be legally bad enough. But again, if you have some common sense, I think what you need to see is that the body trying to enforce these rules has this kind of rule of thumb for a reason, because they have a lot of cases, I'm sure, and this rule of thumb that above 4%, definitely you need to investigate, suggests to me at least that there's a lot of cases where less than 4% are dying, where probably they're not investigating, where something bad happened. And if an inspector is on the ball, then perhaps they can find the one chicken who suffered in an otherwise fine load of chickens. But that's probably not what's happening. So mm-hmm. I think in the same case, or one of the same cases, in defense, the person transporting the chickens actually said, well, actually, the usual death rate is about 10%.
Yeah,
I'm recalling correctly. And, you know, that's not a defense that makes me feel great about eating chicken or eggs.
Right.
Although at this time I did have eggs this morning, I should tell you.
It's okay. I ate meat as well, so yeah. And if animals
we're a part of this, Grace. We're a part of this. We're a part of this paper that I wrote about.
Unfortunately.
Yeah.
It should probably go back to being vegan, but it's pretty hard. If animals aren't fit to transport, that will be a monetary loss to farmers. But is regulating transport more of a band-aid than a cure? And shouldn't there be adequate regulations regarding how animals are raised and cared for in general?
Yeah, I think there are such regulations, so I think it might be helpful to remind people reading the paper that, you know, I'm just looking at one slice of the regulations about transport. So I don't think we should conclude from that everything that happens on the farm and what happens in the slaughterhouse is not regulated. It is. And I think there are federal regulations during transit. And if I'm recalling correctly, what happens on the farm, it's provincially regulated. And mm-hmm. slaughterhouses, I forget who's regulating that. And so this is just a particular window into this broader system, but different bodies, you know, there's a patchwork of stuff, and this is just one of the patches.
Mm-hmm. And how could regulations or legislation make that cultural change and enforce those regulations effectively?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think it's more broadly true of all of our administrative system, which is, you know, how can we get better at getting the outcomes we want? But mm-hmm. I think there's a case near the end of the paper which comes up, in which the tribunal says, look, if Parliament really wanted to require that trucks keep the chickens more warm, and there were to require heated trailers so that all these chickens weren't dying, they could do it. They just haven't.
Yeah.
So the first response to your question, I think, is we can opt to change the rules to make it more favorable. To reflect more what the agricultural business actors want, or we could change the rules to probably protect animals more. And we should always remember that we can change the rules we've got. And these poor tribunals struggling to apply these rules are dealing with the rules that we give them, which are in our control. So I'm sure, also could spend more money on enforcing the rules that we've got. And I think this system, like all of our systems related to food and our water, it's not like every water sample and every piece of food that we eat are being tested. They're not. You know, the broccoli we eat, I'm sure a tiny fraction of that is tested. And in theory, there's enough disincentives for doing something really bad to minimize the bad stuff that happens, but there's a reason that we have you know, food that gets recalled and people who unfortunately still die from time to time from, you know, bad food.
Right.
So I think part of the more complete answer is, you know, we can always find more efficient ways to regulate. And it doesn't mean that the government has to do everything. I think there's some constellation of fines and case law and federal enforcement and clear rules that we as citizens give to our agencies that will produce the outcomes we want. But maybe there's this sneaking suggestion as you take a careful look at what the rules we've got and how it works is that we're kind of getting what we ask for.
Mm-hmm.
And what we were getting is a lot of animal suffering.
Right.
And in part because perhaps we don't want to pay to protect them. And in part, it's got to be because, you know, a lot of us don't care that much. So, and we have to be honest about that.
Mm-hmm. Now, going back to the fact that the word undo was removed before suffering, what have been the implications for further decisions now that the word undo has been removed?
Yeah, well, there's this, I wonder how you read the paper, but there's this twist that happens, which maybe takes the oomph out of the paper a little bit, which is that I look at 20 years of interpretations of undo suffering, and then the word undo disappears in 2020.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So you might ask yourself how relevant it is to understand how an undue suffering was interpreted now that, you know, all we care about now is suffering tout court. Mm-hmm. And it's to be determined, it's to be seen. You know, we need to look at the more recent cases to see whether the tribunal was behaving really differently based on the new language. And I was suggesting earlier that there's, you know, this implication that whereas before the word undo was doing a lot of the work of trying to balance the needs of the animals with the needs of the agricultural, agri-food business,
mm-hmm.
you know, you could have the same balancing in the word suffering. And you could say, well, there's pain and there's some adaptive stress, but it's not suffering. And so really we have to make the same judgment, which is, you know, what amounts to a wrong that is sufficiently bad that we want to make it penalizable by the state. And we still, that process remains with us now.
And near the end of your piece, you say to truly end suffering and death from transportation would require a dramatic shift in the methods and technologies currently in use, along with much higher costs to industry and consumers. Do you see this shift ever coming to fruition?
I mean, when you buy eggs, if you go to the store,
mm-hmm.
you'll see there's a lot of different priced eggs.
Yeah.
There's some really expensive eggs.
Yeah.
And there's some much cheaper eggs. Unfortunately, all eggs are more expensive these days because of inflation. But,
mm-hmm.
You know, people are choosing the more expensive eggs and a lot of people are not. So it's good that we have those options and one has to hope that the more expensive eggs are actually resulting in less suffering chickens and perhaps less, you know, a better, higher quality product, which is kind of another matter. But at some level, yes, we can change things. It's not that complicated. If we decide that we want to weigh more heavily the well-being of animals, there's obvious ways that we could change the system that we've got. And, you know, as I was saying earlier, there is one of the tribunal decisions that says something to that effect, saying, you know, if we really wanted to stop all the chickens from Not all of them, but we pretty much wanted to protect chickens en route from breaking their wings and not freezing to death. We could mandate new rules. And in that case, it would probably be really a lot more expensive, and the consumer would bear that cost at the end of the day, as the producer would pass it along to them. So legal rules are not immutable and they're changeable, and this area is the same as anywhere else. And it only will happen if the country and our elected leadership and our bureaucracies who are in charge of enforcing the guidance that our government gives wants something different. And I'm not sure where the wind is blowing these days, and hopefully one of the this paper can be part of this broader conversation, in the sense that I'm trying to show here's what we've got, or here's what we had until very recently. If you don't like it, it's in our power to change it. And I certainly learned a lot looking at the application of the rules as they were, and hopefully other people will have some value, see some value in that. And the rules are always in our hands to change if we want.
And since your article has been published, has there been any legal development in this area?
I was hoping, Grace, you would tell me.
I'm not sure myself.
I'm joking, I'm joking. I'm not sure. I'm not sure. But I hope, yeah, I should, after this podcast, go check out how have the last 3 years of cases gone, or an enterprising student or researcher who hears this podcast might check out. How are the new rules panning out? And I think there is room for more qualitative research, as I was suggesting earlier, to talk to the people trying to enforce the rules, to kind of dig one layer deeper, because I am relying in this paper on 157, I think, cases, or 159 cases from this tribunal. And that just reflects, it's a sample that is accessible and interesting and clear, but there's a lot more, below the water level that we could look at. And I think that's an open question that it's worth, digging away at.
And for the last question, we're curious to know, since your article has been published, has there been any commentary of your article?
Not that I'm aware of, but it only came out, I don't know when this podcast will air, but it didn't come out that long ago. So I think it was published about 2 months ago. So the world has not dramatically shifted as a result of my article, and maybe that is not that surprising, but I hope that over time it can be a resource among a long list of resources for people who want to think through these issues. And hopefully someone will see it and learn something from it and take the debate in another direction and keep digging. There's lots of digging to be done, and it was a shock to me that this tribunal's work had not been studied more carefully. And this is just kind of a first take at a particular angle, but there's lots and lots there, and these are tricky and important issues. So I hope that it's part of this larger conversation, and I hope that having this conversation with you allows it to reach a few more people who can keep that conversation going.
Yes, hopefully. Well, this concludes episode 9 of the OLR podcast. I would like to thank our guest, Mr. Andrew Stobo-Snyderman, for speaking with me today. I would also like
Thanks,
to
Grace.
thank the OLR podcast committee for preparing questions for this episode and for editing and transcribing this episode in both English and French. And lastly, thank you all for listening.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.